Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags and I've got 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 6th of August, and coming up on the program, the Deputy Finance Minister on key GNU priorities, an extended interview. Why companies and consumers are often disconnected. Do amendments to the Companies Bill now signed into law impact shareholder rights and a new South African international child adoption hurdle? I don't need to tell you that the South African economy is facing significant challenges marked by slow growth, high unemployment, and persistent structural issues. Despite being one of Africa's most industrialized nations, the country is grappling with economic stagnation due to a combination of domestic and global factors, load shedding, labor market rigidity, and socio-political uncertainty, all hindering business confidence and investment. So is there some new thinking now from the new Government of National Unity Deputy Finance Minister Ashur Sarupan? He joined me earlier, and firstly, Deputy Minister, give me a sense of the scope of your remit.
Yeah, that's a very important question and a really good one, Jeremy. Ultimately, the delegations that are assigned in consultation with the ministers and the presidents, Enoch Gunawan and I have had a very good relationship despite being at loggerheads over many years in various issues. And so there's a level of mutual trust between us at least. And so he's given me a whole series of delegations, including intergovernmental fiscal relations, which deals with provincial and local government finance. He has given me international and regional economic policies. So that's the IMF, the World Bank, the New Development Bank, SADC, fiscal relations, all of those sorts of areas of responsibility. He's also given me corporate services, which is the day-to-day running of the Treasury in terms of its own internal HR management, financial management, those sorts of areas. So he's given me quite a wide remit. He's also given me charge of various entities in the Treasury, including the Fiscal and Finance Commission, which reports to the ministers a constitutional institution. He has given me the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, the Accounting Standards Board, the Office of the Tax Ombud, and various other entities to take care of. So I've been given quite a wide berth, far more than I anticipated.
I was going to say that's the job on a Monday, then let's move on to Tuesday. But I'd be very interested to know, in your own words then, describe the state of South Africa's economy, and do you have an optimistic view?
So let me start by describing the state, because we've got to be honest about the diagnosis. South African state is heavily indebted. We basically spend 20% of revenue now on servicing debt, and debt to GDP has ballooned, and it's ballooned because of bailouts. And we must be clear and honest and blunt about that fact. As a consequence of that, public services have declined and infrastructure has declined because the spending and bailouts has crowded out infrastructure investments, and it has crowded out critical spending on education and healthcare and other enablers, public services side, security, police, etc., that enable economic activity. And that's the blunt and frank assessment. We must keep that front and center. So when you consider that, I would say in the simple terms that the state of the economy is not good. It is a very, very bad diagnosis. However, when you look at other countries, middle-income countries grappling with problems, Nigeria and elsewhere, the kind of structural decisions they need to make are much harsher than the ones that we need to make. In Nigeria, they've just had to cut their fuel subsidies. That's triggered nationwide protests and so on. We don't have those levels of distortions. And so on a political level, it should be easier to make the right decisions. So that covers the first half of your question. Then you asked me about structure and structural reforms, and do I think that there's optimism? I am optimistic precisely because the decisions, if we are not ideological about what needs to be done over the next 5 years and are straight up pragmatic, the decisions that need to be taken can get the economy moving again. As you said at the start, we're the most industrialized economy in Africa. For many investors, and I've been spending a lot of time in my first month in office speaking to and reassuring a whole lot of investors that South Africa is bankable still, and development finance institutions. And that gives me a sense for optimism that if we take the right decisions now, and some of them have to be a little bit painful, but we take them early, we'll reap the rewards towards the end of the political term of office, which should be good for everyone in the GNU politically. But more importantly, it'll get South Africa on a growth trajectory. And there is a pathway to getting to 3.5% growth per annum, which will be above the population growth rate, which is about 1.6%. And then we can at least be more absorptive in the economy and jobs than the population growth rate, which is a critical indicator to get right.
So I would imagine the approach is eating the elephant one bite at a time. You talk about painful decisions that need to be made. What would some of those be, and how do you rank them?
Yeah, so I think that the first is getting debt under control. That is, our debt to GDP is unsustainable at 74.6%, and it's set to start declining after 2026 when the last of the Eskom debt transfers are done. But that's going to require slashes to the fiscal, because we've already gone through for this year for the first time painful cuts, raw budget cuts across various government departments. And that will have to continue. We'll have to continue down this path of strong fiscal consolidation over the next while. And that requires government departments to really take a surgical approach to their budgets and cut out things. We have this problem in government where programs are set up because they sound good but are not assessed for impact. And it's going to require a lot of work rather than saying, okay, well, this is a political imperative and so on, to actually say, regardless of its political imperative, does it have an impact if it doesn't surgically cut it out to save money? And there's some difficult decisions there to make because some of it might be politically unpopular. So that's the top of the list, getting rid of the debt and getting it down to our emerging market peers between 60 and 70%. And we should get there by the end of the decade if there's political. The second one is, of course, no new bailouts. It is in this year's budget for the first time. There's a commitment there will be no new bailouts. And cabinet and the president and others need to have steely political will to stare down the state-owned companies and say, shape up or ship out. And we cannot afford any more bailouts. We have crowded out everything else over a decade for you guys. That's the second one. The third is structural reforms and getting the right structural reforms into the system. We've been through phase one of Operation Vulindlela and started some of the right market reforms and getting spectrum auctioned off, starting to concession the ports. Of course, Durban is in the pipeline to be concessioned pending the outcome of a court case. But we've got to accelerate that and then move into the other blockages, getting the Cape Town port sorted, and hopefully through a concession model is the ideal one, and it's my preferred one. Then, of course, we've got to sort out the freight rail network so we can get goods out of the country and to export markets, because it's one thing to speak about an export-oriented economy, but when public monopolies disable that kind of economic activity, it's a pipe dream. So we've got to fix all of those areas. On energy, it's about time. It was in phase one of Vulindlela. I hope it goes through to phase two, and I've had several meetings about this. But the critical thing is that within this delivery unit held between Treasury and the Presidency, phase two of Vulindlela has got to break up Eskom into transmission, generation, and distribution, because we have got to be able to now invest in transmission to sort out load shedding, as you also mentioned earlier. It is a critical economic disabler. And because our transmission infrastructure is designed to transmit power from the north of the country to the rest, from basically heavy and expensive and pollutive coal-fired power plants to the rest of the country, we now need a massive amount of transmission investments to be able to transmit renewable power from the west and the south of the country up north and to the rest of the country as well. So that's going to require major investments. And we've got to unlock that investment, which gets to the fourth thing, and that is we've got to enable private sector participation and investment, and we've got to drop ideological resistance to, for example, the IFC, International Finance Corporation, and the World Bank. A lot of the funding from these things are the kind of funding we need. It's development finance, interest rates as little as 2 or 1%. When we go and we sell government bonds, which is our preferred debt mechanism in South Africa, we do so at market rates, but development finance comes in at very cheap rates. And so we've got to just drop the ideological resistance to development finance from the World Bank and the IFC and use that money as cheap money, really, on the four countries that need to get development infrastructure in place. And then, of course, we need to look at the other disablers. Water security is quite high up there, as we see our metros going without water. And that takes me to the sixth one, which is something that I'm beginning to work on and speaking to experts on. And that's reformulating the local government finance model, because as we know, local government is in omni-shambles in half the country. And part of the problem, of course, is corruption. But the other half of the problem is the financial model is unsustainable and fixing that. And if we can do those five things, we can enable economic activity, create the conditions in which businesses that are in place can grow and new investment can be unlocked. Mm.
So many of those priorities that you've listed thread back to state-owned enterprises, and you talk about having the steely will to actually do this. How do you know that that is actually going to happen? Because if you don't have that will, if there is a buckle somewhere in the chain, you're going to be in all sorts of difficulty.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Operation Vulindlela is quite important. The idea behind Operation Vulindlela comes from an idea actually that came in with the Labour government in 97 in the UK by Sir Michael Barber, and that's setting up a delivery unit whose narrow focus is on these critical things. And that's why Vulindlela Phase 2 is going to be quite important, because if all of these things are in Vulindlela Phase 2, and the signs are very promising that they are going to be in there, and I look forward to that announcement coming out in due course, and I think that'll reassure the markets. But civil servants, public servants, will do what they're told to do over and over again. And because government is siloed, and under the Zuma era of state capture, the cabinet system broke down, it is absolutely critical that you make sure that you get these things focused on. And that's where a strong political support for Vulindlela is going to be very important. Because if we can deliver on these things and then cabinet gets behind it and supports it, I think that we can get it right. It was already a big decision for the governing party, at the previous governing party, of course, to have a start of the process to concession out a port, considering its ideological proclivities. And I think that now that the world hasn't ended with that process happening, hopefully it'll open up more opportunities to take those kinds of decisions that'll get the economy moving again.
And I am going to leave it there. Deputy Finance Minister Ashur Sarupan, thank you very much for joining me.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
According to Alan Gray governance analyst Nicole Hamann, the proposed 2023 Companies Amendment Bill seeks to integrate shareholder approval on executive remuneration into the Companies Act. But she warns it could harm shareholder rights, weaken shareholder influence, and also diminish the quality of executive remuneration schemes. She joins me on the program now. Welcome to you. And first of all, then, what are your concerns?
Sure. So it's now been signed into law by the president. So it's now Companies Act amendments. We're just waiting for him to communicate an effective date. The concern for us is really how it applies to JSE listed companies, because in the case of JSE listed companies, there are already existing shareholder rights over executive remuneration that is, you know, housed in the JSE listing requirements. And this is what we've used for the last few years. It's been introduced in 2017. So the concern for us was really the current process. The Companies Act amendments outlines a very different set of shareholder requirements than the current process. And in fact, it's kind of been positioned as moving from advisory resolutions to binding resolutions. So shareholder rights are increasing and being strengthened. But in practice, a number of variables are changing, which is concerning to us. For example, the nature of the resolution is changing. So previously, there's kind of a soft 75% shareholder support hurdle rate, which is required, because any less than that, then companies have to invite shareholders to engage. That, for example, is changing to only 50%, where only, you know, 2% of the JSE top 100 companies actually get remuneration policy support less than 50%. So, you know, that's one of the aspects. Mm. There's also the engagement with shareholders that's changing, and also the frequency of the vote. So, you know, all in all, for us, particularly for JSE listed companies, we don't think it's an improvement to the existing shareholder rights.
Why do you believe specifically that a higher threshold is necessary?
So with that higher threshold, there's an engagement platform that comes with it. So at the moment, where companies get more than 25% opposition, they have to invite shareholders to engage with them. And that's the platform that we take up. So we try and engage constructively, outline exactly what we think our concerns are, what are the recommendations for improvement. And we have seen companies take that on year and make improvements. So it's really that because that 25% is there, minority shareholders who in aggregate have more than 25% of the voting rights, you are able to then get a platform with the company and a voice at the table to voice concerns. Whereas if we're moving to 50%, there's none of that engagement platform anymore. So you could have up to 49% of shareholders opposing a remuneration policy, but it would pass and stay in place for 3 years. And that's really the concerning part for us, that engagement.
Technically, how difficult do you think this is going to be to implement?
It actually relies on how the JSE listing requirements will be updated, because they now need to be updated in response to the Companies Act amendments. So hopefully that will come out. They usually have a very robust public consultation process, so we'll take part in that and try and emphasize we still want some form of shareholder engagement. And then it's really up to companies how they're going to view this 50% ordinary resolution approval. You know, if companies are still going to strive for 80-90%, if they'll now be complacent with 50%. So it's really up to, you know, I think guidance and practice to fill the gaps of what is possibly poor regulation in terms of, you know, this 50% requirement.
Do you think there are specific performance conditions and targets that should be prioritized?
It's very much on a case-by-case basis for us. We like to take into account the specific position of the company, the industry, where they find themselves in their life cycle. But, you know, where there is a reasonable peer group, we always recommend that relative total shareholder return be considered, just because it takes into account factors that your peers are also facing. And, you know, it tries to reward executives for what is within their control and not perhaps just, you know, the upswing of a cyclical industry. So that's always something we recommend, you know, where it is possible. It's not always possible, but then it's very much what is the specific drivers of the business. And that differs from company to company.
On a broader canvas, you've also raised concern about concentrated ownership in South Africa.
Yes, that's correct. And that comes through in the voting rights, even AGM participation. Not all shareholders vote at AGMs. I think the participation's around, you know, the 80% mark. So you don't have a lot of external shareholders always voting, and there are a lot of these insider positions. So it just makes it very difficult for resolutions to drop below that 50% mark for policies specifically.
So do you think that there are better ways or a better way of revising the CAB to protect shareholders' rights on the one hand, but also encouraging the development of good, tough remuneration schemes on the other?
Yes, so during our feedback, you know, we tried to outline there is this current process and there are flaws, but there are a lot of ways it can be improved. And, you know, something issuers always tell us, they say there is this invitation to engage with shareholders, but a lot of shareholders don't actually take them up on it. So something just where shareholders over a certain percentage of shares, you should communicate to companies your voting rationale when you do vote negatively, which is quite reasonable. If you're voting against a policy, you should be transparent about the reasons why, so that companies can be equipped with the information to make improvements on their side. So that's something that, you know, would improve the communication on both sides of the spectrum for issuers and for shareholders. So that's a way the process could be improved.
Nicole Hamann, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
I want to focus now on the 6th South African Customer Experience Report that shows a real disconnect between what businesses think drives repeat business, both on and offline among consumers, versus how consumers actually behave. Authored in part by the agency Roger Wilco's Chief Executive Officer Charlie Stewart, the report goes on to say that while around 70% of consumers want a reliable service and or product offering that they can depend on and will buy from again and again, the same percentage, conversely, of businesses believe that repeat purchases are due to customers trusting them. Charlie Stewart, welcome. So explain the disconnect.
For the last couple of years, we've really been trying to drill into the contrast between the consumer expectation and the business delivery. This year, we found a number of fairly significant disconnects. Some of them
really center around the reasons why people make repeat purchases or are loyal to brands. We asked a question to both the audiences, to the 2,000 consumers and to the 75 business professionals who completed the study. And the majority of consumers say that they buy from businesses because they are reliable, because the product or service that they receive is delivered on time or it works, it comes out of the box as stated. But business didn't really believe that. Business thought that trust was the largest reason that people were buying from them again. 71% of businesses said that trust was the primary driver, but only 34% of consumers echoed that sentiment. We saw a similar disconnect around stock availability. 60% of consumers say that's why they buy again, but just 19% of businesses felt that was the case. We saw similar disconnects around business and consumers' views on whether they are heard and whether their feedback is acted on. 52% of consumers feel that businesses respond to them. 92% of businesses feel that they act and respond on consumer feedback. So there were lots and lots of different gaps. We saw gaps at an ESG level. That's been a fairly controversial trending topic over the last few years. 29% of consumers say that an organization's environmental goals, its efforts around sustainability and the like, are important to them, but just 16% of businesses thought that those were important factors for consumers. Mm. Disconnects across a fairly large number of levels, Jeremy.
Why do you think businesses overestimate the role of trust in driving repeat purchases?
I think that they struggle to grapple with the concept of trust. And another area of the report, and this is an area that we've looked at ever since the first edition of the report back in 2019, was what do people do when they have a good experience? What do they do when they have a bad experience? And what are the real drivers and sources of information that consumers go to when they're looking to make that decision to buy a product? And it comes down to reviews. And consumers like to hear from the mouths of other people who've lived through that purchase journey, whether or not the company that they're considering buying from is any good, whether it's going to deliver on its promise. And it's incredibly difficult for business to engineer those reviews. Although consumers tell us that they are very happy to provide reviews when they get good service, I think there's a bit of a disconnect between sometimes what people tell us they will do and their actual follow through on that. But, word of mouth reviews, hearing from your friends and family about their positive experiences. I mean, I think that resonates with all of us. If we're off to go and buy a new car, we're going to go and ask people who drive that car whether it's good or not. And we'll take their word at face value and put much more credence in it than we would the word of a car salesman or the brand that's trying to sell us the product.
So how can a business do better at that side of the equation? How do they capitalize on that, on the power of the word of mouth?
I think it's incredibly difficult, but I think there's a missed opportunity in really building the consumer opinion piece out. I think that businesses have tried to use influencers in the past to do that, and I think that's worked with a degree of success. But I think that certainly the more recent approach to using micro-influencers helps because they're a little bit more credible. They're people that we can relate to. But the simple act of asking the consumer at the point of delivery, have you had a good experience? What do you think about it? Will you rate us? Internationally, it's rare to go onto a website, whether it's selling software to a business or whether it's selling cat food to a consumer, without seeing either trust advisor ratings, where consumers have been asked to go and rate the service delivery, or seeing lots of individual product reviews. Now, although a lot of the e-commerce sites in South Africa do feature product reviews, there are very few of them that tap into solutions like Trust Advisor, where we're able to immediately see that rating and review scorecard that is generated. So I think there's work that can be done there. I completely understand that getting reviews can be like drawing teeth, but there's nothing wrong with asking.
All of that is from the 6th South African Customer Experience Report from Roger Wilco, Charlie Stewart. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Netherlands and Denmark have told South Africa of their plans to phase out adoptions from this country by next year. They cite challenges in tracing biological parents as a key factor. Let me explore that in a little more detail now with Lumka Olifant, Director of Communications Department of Social Development. Welcome. Thank you for joining me. I'm interested to know how many adoptions actually take place from these two countries.
We don't have too many adoptions, Jeremy, that go to these countries, and the numbers are quite low. But I think what they have said to us, it's not just for South Africa, but it is what they are seeing across the world, that eventually children, once they become adults, they want to know who they, where they come from. And for some reason, while I was on YouTube the other day, I then saw a complete documentary on the Netherlands and what they have been finding in within their country on international adoptions, and how in their country, you know, there have been gaps and also problems within the system. So they now are saying that to protect their credibility as a country and also to look at as to have good relations, they want to phase out international adoptions, not just for South Africa, but we happen to be one of the countries where we were a sending country to these two countries.
Does South Africa's national adoption program, though, need to change in any way to facilitate inter-country adoptions itself?
We will have to look what the trends are, and the reason we're having this conversation, Jeremy, is that what is the data telling us? What are countries also telling us in terms of how do we strengthen the child protection system of the country? Maybe another example I can just give you is that we have what is called the Child Protection Register, where would-be employers would check in our system if people are unsuitable to work with children. We are also finding now that South Africans, as they are being understanding more and more of their obligations, they are also asking if the migrants that are coming from neighboring countries are appearing in our register. So also it gives us now conversations to talk with other countries on child protection system as a whole. But coming to adoption, we will have to play a wait and see if this is going to be a trend that we are going to have as countries are looking at their own inter-country adoptions. And that then will have to then inform where we go in terms of inter-country adoptions.
The single biggest problem, of course, facing South Africa is a lack of qualified social workers to make sure that the program is well moderated, regulated, and managed.
That's not true, Jeremy, because we have started now as a Department of Social Development to we changed the Children's Act and added as a social development social workers. And we are seeing more people now coming in because now we have made it as a statutory service. We have made it not an elite service, but a service that people can walk in the Department of Social Development, and they can be able to say, I would like to adopt a child, and that can be done. Previously, this service was done by private social workers. Now that we have added social workers of the department, we are seeing more understanding. We are seeing more numbers going up. We are seeing people also being open to adoption. Remember, as well as a people, Jeremy, we do these things as part of our day-to-day living. When a child loses a parent, most of South Africans, they take in their child as part of the family, but without involving, you know, the state and making sure that there are things that are happening. We are a people that when children don't have parents, we take them in. But now we need then to strengthen the communication and people understanding the difference between adoption and the difference between adoption and foster care and what that means. We are also seeing that people don't understand that once you decide that as a couple, for instance, you decide to adopt each other's children, when you are divorcing, you can't divorce the children and think that you are, because you are the biological parent of these adopted children, automatically you will have a custody of the children. We must always look at situations and have the best interest of our children for every decision that we make.
Let me ask you this question in conclusion. Both of these countries also pointed out irregularities within the private adoption sector. What are those, and what steps, in your department's opinion, would need to be taken to address those issues?
This is why we decided that we need to make sure that the officials of department, the social workers of the department, are now the ones that can also perform adoptions. We had seen in the previously that, number one, the private social workers were charging exorbitant amounts of in order to do the administration, and some also were just cutting corners. Remember, as part of the adoption process, you have to make sure that you publish the names of adoptable children. Sometimes they would not do this, and children would just be sent out and adopted. One of the things that we are doing now is to say you can come to the Department of Social Development for better protection of children and accountability of where our children are going and who is adopting them, and also working very closely with Home Affairs, because Home Affairs is a partner to us here because of the registration and the changing of the surnames and the parents and everything else. So we've strengthened all of these systems so that we can be able to account for the children. And also, most importantly, Jeremy, there is a platform where those who have who had adopted as kids can be able to ask who their biological parents are. But sometimes the biological parents say, no, we don't want, I gave you up for adoption. Or the child, when the biological parent wants to trace their children, and the child says, no, I can't, I don't want to see you. You gave me up for adoption. So as we communicate and we are becoming a better democracy, people are starting to understand these things and are embracing all the things that we are doing.
Lumka Olifan, thank you very much indeed, Director Communications at the Department of Social Development. On our last online poll, I asked the question, was poor communication to blame for the ANC's election woes? Yes, no, or much more than that. And that was the response from over 80% of our respondents. And today, linked to an earlier interview we did, do local companies, I'm asking, act with a real consumer mindset? Yes, no, or I'm constantly disappointed. If you have a view, an invitation to go to our X or LinkedIn page. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.